I want to play a game. The 3 train is arriving in 2 minutes. It is up to you to decide if this will be your final stop. Live or die, make your choice.
Can you hear me? I've had enough. Got my dick dipped in bird seed. This truck is tied to my nuts. Okay, I'll admit it. I took some bribes. I'm mad corrupt. He's making me cut up my own hair and burn it up. And then pull in a spliff and take a puff. I just got one question for you, Jigsaw.
Why do you sound like an accountant?
Yeah.
What I sound like is relevant. Look inside the matchbox and you'll find a tiny gun. Take it out, shoot yourself in the face while killing someone on the train at the same time. Fail to do this and your lives will be exposed to the entire world. If you do it, you may survive. Go now.
You're in trouble now!
That was You're in Trouble Now by Gandhi. His new album, Lies of the Saw Master, is available on XCLEX Records, and it is a banger. And one of the big reasons for that is it has the rap stylings of the genius Johnny Pemberton, who, by the way, has got a live comedy tour coming up with Amy Miller. It starts July 15th at the Alameda Comedy Club in California. Makes its way up the West Coast, then to Oregon, then to the West Coast. And then he makes it to Vegas and Bisbee and Tucson, Arizona. It wraps up July 30th. It's the Double Dust Off Live Comedy Tour. Go to Johnny Pemberton's Twitter for all those dates. That's at Johnny Pemberton. Are we living in some kind of synthetic reality created by a malevolent intelligence? Is everything just fake? Fraud? The whole goddamn thing? Life is but a stage, and that's it. Not even that great a stage, like a low-grade high school stage in a severely underfunded school district where the drama teacher has a meth problem. Spin all the drama money on methamphetamine, shots of tequila, the night before they began construction of their new set. Is that what reality is? In this case, is the art director the demiurge? And are we doomed to go through infinite renditions of some horrible, watered-down, duplicated, highly censored garbage script that maybe at one time was an incredible Broadway show, but now just sucks? And is there potential for liberation from this nauseating eternalism? Today, we're gonna find out. Our wonderful and much esteemed guest, Miguel Connor, is an expert in something that I am very interested in and confused by: Gnosticism. Maybe you have listened to his wonderful podcast, Aeon Byte Gnostic Radio. Regardless, you should listen to him now, because just maybe he holds the keys to the theater that we are all currently trapped in. We're going to jump right into it, but first this. A tremendous thank you to Squarespace for supporting this sacred, mystical, and potentially spiritually liberating episode of the DTFH. My dear loves, you might recall that the last Squarespace commercial, I mentioned the availability of the domain surpriselotionclown.com. I was shocked to see
that in an age where the surprise lotion clown craze is getting national coverage by the mainstream media, and so many people are either thrilled to get a surprise lotion clown, there's a lot of controversy around these lotion clowns, the way they're being treated by some of the services, that the actual domain name surpriselotionclown.com had not been scooped up. And I offered it to my listeners, and one of my brilliant listeners jumped and went to Squarespace and bought the domain surpriselotionclown.com and created a beautiful, thriving website. A website that is now thriving. Here, just listen to this.
Yes, my name is Booze McKenzie. I was trying to schedule a surprise lotion clown. I'm hoping this will be a surprise. I've been let down by several other lotion clown outfits that have not surprised me. They're very easy to see coming. So I'm at the grocery store down the street usually every day from 5 to 6. I have my earbuds in, so I'm not paying attention. And this is definitely, it's not sexual, but it is something I would prefer to have happen to me in public, or maybe be removed from a public setting and taken somewhere private. I would describe my body as tender and portly and somewhat hairy. Feel free to return my call at 847.
That is but one recording from SurpriseLotionClown.com. You go to SurpriseLotionClown.com, a Squarespace website, and you're going to see over 10 at this point passionate requests for a Surprise Lotion Clown. And that is what we call business, aka the American dream. And it can all be yours by going to Squarespace.com. Yeah, sure, SurpriseLotionClown.com is gone, but you know what's not gone? SurpriseLotionClownControversy.com. If you wanted to, you could grab it right now and create a website detailing all the controversy surrounding this issue of the surprise lotion clown craze. These clowns are being mistreated by some of these outfits. Some of these clowns are trying to unionize and being actively prevented from doing so by the surprise lotion clown elite cabal that is, up until this point, had a pretty intense stranglehold on the entire industry until SurpriseLotionClown.com came along. And I can assure you, because I've had communication with the creator of SurpriseLotionClown.com, that they're treating their clowns ethically. The point is this: if you want to make a beautiful, powerful website like Surprise Lotion Clown, and you want to create it quickly, Squarespace gives you all the tools you need to do such a thing. If you want to create a deep, complex, beautiful, subtle, refined, divine exhalation, as it's been described by some top scholars, you can make that as well with Squarespace. You want to see what that looks like? Go to DuncanTrussell.com. Squarespace, they've got amazing customer support. They've got wonderful marketing tools. They're not limited to creating websites. You want to do email campaigns, send out emails to your clients, they can do that for you. You're interested in metrics and data. You want to know who's coming from where and what's going on with your client base. They've got that too. They have everything you need. And of course, they have shopping cart functionality. Whatever you want, award-winning mix and match templates that allow you to create spectacular, powerful, and potent websites like SurpriseLotionClown.com. Head over to Squarespace.com/Duncan and try it out. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you will get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Again, it's squarespace.com/Duncan. Try it out for free. When you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan. You're going to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace, and thank you, SurpriseLotionClown.com. Pals, I want to invite you to subscribe to my Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. You're going to get so much extra DTFH related stuff, including, if you're interested, a weekly meditation group where we all gather together once a week, our journey into boredom, that's every Monday, and our Friday family gathering Today we talked about there are some folks out there who nebulize their own urine. Wonderful family gathering today. Come home to your family. Patreon.com/DTFH. Holy shit, we've got a lot of announcements, friends. But these are good announcements. My meditation teacher, David Nickturn, who I'm very lucky to have in my life, is offering a new course, Foundations of Mindfulness. It starts July 19th. And the link to get to that is going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. But if you want to just go there now, it's dharmamoon.com/foundations of mindfulness. You can just Google it and find it. Definitely take the class. He is a brilliant Buddhist teacher. I have to offer a personal thanks to one of my friends, Drew Lewis, for making today's podcast happen. Our guest today describes himself as a garage philosopher. I think he's a philosopher. He's an expert on Gnosticism and alchemy and Hermeticism and all the topics that I love so much. And I was so lucky to be able to spend an hour with him today asking all the questions I've had for a very long time about Gnosticism. This is one of my favorite podcasts. Episodes in a long time, and I hope you all will stay tuned for today's guest. He is the host of the Aeon Byte Gnostic radio show that's on YouTube. He's got a lovely Twitter at Aeon Byte. That's AEONBYTE. Follow him on Twitter. Connect to this brilliant human. His website is thegodabovegod.com. Now, everybody, please welcome to the DTFH for what I hope will be the first of many conversations, Miguel Connor. Miguel, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
You know, as I've been preparing for our conversation today, I find myself in a wonderful predicament, which is I have so many things I want to ask you. I don't know where to start, so I guess I'm going to start with the most boring, mundane, but I think essential question for folks listening who aren't familiar with Gnosticism at all, or have only vaguely heard of it. Can you give us an extremely brief history of Gnosticism? Because I'd rather get into the philosophy, and I know the philosophy and history are intertwined, but it'd be nice to have a little background to use as the diving board that we're going to jump in to the subject from.
Woo, yeah, that's, let's see, the elevator pitch. I'm trying to sell you on these evil heretics 2,000 years ago that's whose philosophy seems very more relevant than ever, I'm sure, as we'll talk about. I guess to start as a good baseline or foundation, I would tell your audience, think of the movie The Matrix. That right there is a modern Gnostic gospel. If any of your audience likes Philip K. Dick, Gnosticism hugely influenced him. And if your audience likes the ideas of Carl Jung, you've got Gnosticism. If you want something even more modern, I'm starting to realize the Matrix is getting kind of dated for like Zoomers and so forth. But then think of the Lego movie or the TV series Westworld or the recent film Bliss or something like that. But in short, the Gnostics were a movement that started, or actually I would say, gained maturity about 2,000 years ago and sort of branched out into two ways. One is the pagan Hermetics and the other is the Christian Gnostics, probably both started in Alexandria, Egypt, that great metropolis where all these ideas sort of stewed and so much speculation. We got the Neoplatonists, mystic Hellenistic Jews, just Coptic Christians. Great, but the Gnostics really caused a stir in the nascent Christian religion because they posited that we lived in a simulation. As my friend Gordon White said, the Gnostics didn't say we lived in a false world, because that idea definitely appears in the East. Here in the West, the Gnostics said, no, the idea is not false. This is a faked world. We are trapped in a world that's been coded on purpose to keep us humans here, the concept of the prison planet. And we are here because of something that we have. We have something called a divine spark, as the Gnostics called it 2,000 years, call it the soul, human consciousness. And this sort of divine spark fuels the very, in some texts, the very universe that we live in. And who trapped us here? The Gnostics, they had varying ideas. The Hermetics really were more positive, that matter just fell in love with this divinity and brought us down. And here we are sort of understanding each other. But the Christian Gnostics had a lot of harsher grim. They foresaw like there was this pre-cosmic cataclysm. And basically, in short, as a scholar Stephen Davis said, God went crazy and became us. Part of his essence fell into the universe and was coveted by these soulless mechanical beings that they call the Demiurge and his Archons. And the Gnostics associated the Demiurge with the God of the Old Testament, because they said, there's no way this dude is the father of Jesus. This guy is bad news. But they also associated the Demiurge with other gods like Zeus or Saturn or Osiris. And they had trapped our cosmic divine, our divine spark here to feed on us. So us as humans, we had a duty, or for some of us humans, the ability to wake up and realize that we had a shard of divinity, a shard of eternity within us, and we could basically awaken this cosmic divinity, like Neo in the Matrix taking the red pill.
Yes.
And we could commune with this, as they called it, God above God. Some of the Gnostics called this God above God Abraxas, who makes an appearance in the Midnight Gospel.
Yes.
So we could be awakening by the teachings and facilitation of this Gnostic revealer, like Morpheus in the Matrix. Morpheus' job is to sort of help Neo sort of get himself to becoming the One. We can all become the One. The Gnostics saw this Gnostic revealer as often as Jesus. They didn't see Jesus as sort of saving us from our sins, but waking us up to our true nature, to be able to escape the wrath of the Archons here in this simulation. But they had other Gnostic revealers, Mary Magdalene, Sophia, Simon Magus. Some Gnostics saw the Buddha and Zoroaster as Gnostic revealers. And they could facilitate what you might call our gnosis, a central point of the Gnostics, which is this direct experiential knowledge and connection with this God above God, this higher consciousness, but also also a revelation of this false world that we are trapped in. And this knowledge always seemed in their texts like this ritual, this astral travel, ecstatic ritual. One thing about the Gnostics is they were an ecstatic shamanistic movement. You had to bring yourself into an altered state of consciousness. But at the same time, it's also a mode of self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is very important. As one, again, that scholar Stephen Davis said, my salvation is the same as God's psychotherapy. If I go in and touch upon my divine spark and get rid of all the deprogramming and the false layers of who I am and make contact with my inner God, it's the same as if I took some shamanistic outer journey beyond the stars. So Gnosis was very important to the Gnostics. I think that's a good summary, and
yeah,
you can break down other things like divine spark, reincarnation, how they deconstructed texts, other things you might want to touch upon, but it's a good summary of who the Gnostics were.
That is the best summary I've ever heard of Gnosticism. Thank you. For the listeners, I know there might be a lot there for you to unpack, but I think you probably gathered from it why I love Gnosticism and it will probably be perpetually confused by it. So here's a really blasphemous question for you. And hopefully after hearing your description of Gnosticism, people will even get the question. Sure. You've heard of the game Fuck, Marry, Kill?
No, I have not.
So it's like Fuck, Marry, Kill. If you had these choice, if you had these people to choose from, let's say Donald Trump, the Loch Ness Monster, Santa Claus. You got to fuck one, marry one, kill one. What do you pick? You know, Fuck, Marry, Kill. The Demiurge, Abraxas, Sophia. Which one do you fuck? Which one do you marry? Which one do you kill?
All right. Well, you want to fuck Sophia. You want to...
Why? Why fuck Sophia?
Because Sophia in the Gnostic text, she is a part of God's mind that got lost in the matter. She is the divine goddess that's here to help us remember who we are, even though in some texts she is the reason why the universe fell. She is the disobedient part of God. The Gnostics saw God as a giant mind, this incredible mind that had all these features: truth, faith, honor, and Sophia, wisdom was one of them. And she rebelled because, as some said, she is wisdom. She can't just be static in this timeless realm. She has to experience the world because wisdom wants to experience, wants to know. Some get pretty gritty. Some think that she actually she wanted to have an orgasm by herself because she was a woman. She's Luciferian, and she wanted to sort of rebel and go on her own way. So she falls into the world, and she does give birth to the Demiurge. I think your questions might be hard because if I F Sophia, her son's gonna be furious with me.
You're gonna piss off the Demiurge.
Yeah, exactly. The supreme being of this universe.
Yeah.
So Sophia's a very mercurial, enigmatic figure. Obviously, the Gnostics based it. If you look at some parts of the Old Testament, the Book of Wisdom and others, you will find in Proverbs, you'll find this figure called Wisdom that doesn't seem like a metaphor. She's there with God at the beginning of time. She's there creating with God. So the Gnostics look at the Old Testament and said there's this fallen wisdom. Even the Book of Enoch says wisdom came to the world of men, and everybody rejected her, and she had to go to a cloud. So they assumed this enigmatic figure was wisdom, and they made her part of their myths and their narrative. And of course, it's a great metaphor for we need to find our wisdom in our mind so that we can become sane, just as God needs his wisdom to come back to this eternal realm so it can become sane.
It's like God has gotten lost in some kind of mirror or something, like God looked into something and has become completely like fractalized within that thing, and we're all this strange reflection of a hit. But how is this possible? How is it possible that Abraxas or whatever the like outside the matrix, you know, progenitive force, how is it possible that a thing that is the source should become lost within the reality that emerged from it?
Well, that's a great question everybody's been asking, right? And the Gnostics certainly speculated in their texts different ideas. And this, remember, from the Christian and the Hermetic Gnostics, even though it was persecuted and died out throughout history, it did manifest through the Cathars, the Muslims, Sufis, the Jewish Kabbalists, the Persian Mazdakites. And this Gnostic stream always has existed throughout history, but it's just so edgy because when you tell people this world is a prison, all your churches and institution and governments are controlled by these archons. The very David Icke we're getting, right?
I mean,
David Icke does create sort of a modern Gnostic myth. It doesn't go well with the powers that be, but underground, the Gnostics have always been able to thrive, but very edgy. But they had different explanations. I mean, as some have said, as soon as you have, let's say, in Hinduism, you have that with the Brahman, Vishnu. As soon as consciousness asks the question, who am I? What am I? The answer is going to appear, right? It's like, yes. I am the great conscious. I already become fragmented. I am eternity. I am this. As soon as you become fragmented, you're already losing something or you're also casting a shadow, because as soon as you say, I am good, there has to be a response in the cosmic mind. Well, what the hell is evil?
Yeah.
Or you have to speculate, what is evil? What would evil look like? So these were the answers that as soon as the cosmic consciousness became aware, we had to happen. Evil had to happen, and we had to be trapped. Others were more Zoroastrian. They said, no, that's bullshit. There's always been light and darkness. That's a principle of reality. So therefore, as soon as light starts to stir, darkness is going to wait for its turn to fight. The Christian Gnostics, again, had this idea that wisdom, because they were so dependent on the Jewish scriptures, they were dependent on the goddess Asherah of the old Hebrews and a segment of the Egyptian. They said, no, wisdom rebelled, and that caused a collapse. So they speculated, but again, these myths are trying to explain an existential truth. Like the Neoplatonists and the Greek philosophers, they never said this was literal, but they said this is as close as we're going to get, that feeling that, where am I? You know, the truth in our monkey brains, we're never going to find out on this level of consciousness, Duncan. So best we have is myth. You know, I'm talking Joseph Campbell, that
sure.
Myths are the closest thing that point to a transcendental truth.
Well, one of the many things I love about Gnosticism is that it is where my mind goes when I'm taking like a very powerful psychedelic. There is a sense of a kind of catastrophic situation that has happened where these two things that maybe were never supposed to meet have come together and can't sort themselves out in any kind of harmonious way. And it is producing this feedback loop of suffering that we find ourselves within. And, you know, I don't want that to be the case, but that has been an experience I've had more than a few times on a variety of psychedelics, just as though this horrible, never-ending debate has been going on between matter and spirit, and it can't work itself out. And it just keeps going and going and going. And somehow we've become swirled into
We're the battleground for it. Yeah, each one of us is the battleground of heaven and hell, or matter and spirit, or whatever, you animal and, you know, human, or God. So it's
and so you would expect, if this were the case, for that to it would have to appear in every work of art, every story, everything. In the way that fish are wet, you would expect some strand of this to make its way into just about everything. Maybe you can help settle an argument, but I was telling my wife, I think Mary Had a Little Lamb is some kind of Gnostic him or something. And then she Googles, like, no, it's not. It was 1800s it came from. But have you ever thought of the words of Mary Had a Little Lamb from the perspective of Gnosticism? And please, I will not be offended if you just say, next question.
I honestly, I have. And for some reason, I'm thinking of William Blake and his Tiger, Tiger and the Lamb of God. William Blake was hugely influenced by Gnosticism. So
tiger,
we might
tiger,
have to find a compromise.
Burning bright in the forest of the night. Now, let me just read Mary Had a Little Lamb to you, because sometimes right. I forget. I don't have it memorized. I have more William Blake memorized than Mary Had a Little Lamb. But 1 second. I want to look it up. Nursery rhyme. Again, I'm sorry, y'all. I know we have a great mind with us today. I'm sorry for doing Fuck, Marry, Kill in advance, and I'm sorry for this, but I do think there's a connection. Mary had a little lamb. His fleece was white as snow, and everywhere the children went, that lamb was sure to go. He followed her to school one day. Wait, this is of course someone had to do a revision of it. I have to
like
look up Marietta. Oh,
like
my
a
God.
Like a woke revision now, or something?
Yeah, somebody did it. Like someone decided they're going to do. The point is, Marietta Little Lamb is fleece as white as snow, followed her to school one day. It goes something along the lines of, it made the children laugh and play, and then the teachers turned it out. And so I've heard that and thought, holy shit, is the little lamb, is that Sophia? Is Mary, or you know, the the liberating Gnostic energy is school, the archons, or the teachers, the archons, casting out the light? And did that make its way into nursery rhymes? I don't know, but to me, that is obviously The Matrix is one of the great modern example. But to me, that seems to be a subliminal, I don't know, description of this situation, which is this: the light of God comes into the world. Book of John, in the beginning was the Word was made flesh. The darkness didn't understand it, I think is how it goes, something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
No, you hit it on the head, because the Gnostics were the first to write commentary on the Gospel of John, and many have said it's so Gnostic, because this Jesus is very... The Gnostics saw Jesus as having superpowers. He's a shapeshifter, and he could walk through walls, and he's sort of this amazing being. And you look at the Gospel of John and the message, and it gets very Gnostic. Now, as far as Mary, you're 100% right, and this is another important element. The Gnostics, again, they didn't just pull stuff out of their ass. They were looking at all the great minds. One of them was obviously Plato. If you look at the allegory of the cave, that's a Gnostic myth in 300 BC. We're trapped in a cave, and these archons are putting shadows, and one of us can escape to the light and come warn others. Why are you trapped and looking at shadows instead of seeing? So the Gnostics saw that these great minds were giving Gnostic hints and truths, and then they just sort of, they really brought it into maturity with the Christian Gnostics and the Hermetics. But one of Plato's ideas, the fall of the soul and its adventure in through the spheres and into matter. So that's what Plato said. The soul falls, and it falls in our body. We are in the material world. In Greek and in Hebrew, the soul is feminine. So this great story is clothed as this heroine who falls. But it's always this powerful story about Sophia falling into the world and how she's going to get out. You see that some have said that the Odyssey, Helen of Troy, is the soul falling into the clutches of... Wow. She's the lamb falling into the classroom, but it's Troy. You look at Alice in Wonderland, a great Gnostic Neoplatonic tale. Alice falls from her real world into Wonderland. What does the caterpillar tell Alice? You are a terribly real thing in a terribly fake world, and that's why you are in so much pain, because she's the lost soul. Wizard of Oz, right there. Dorothy falls into this fake world of archons, fake money and witches, and the wizard is sort of the great symbol for the demiurge, because he's just another materialistic profiteering person. So this idea of the soul falling in feminine, Mary, Alice in Wonderland, Dorothy, you see it over and over through literature, art, and movies.
It's such a terrifying way of looking at the world. It creates the possibility for a real kind of paranoid way of looking at just about everything. I've been there. I know a lot of people listening have been there. Those moments where maybe you're too high, maybe you're just having a bad day, and you look around and you think, this shit isn't fucking real. Like, not, it's not, whatever this is isn't anything at all. It's fake as fuck. And then you get, anytime you meet anyone, flipping out, it's a very common...
Like in the Truman Show, when the light falls, from the sky, or he looks over and he sees the engineers. That's a very Gnostic film, and now, we all feel it.
I have a question for you. This is something in my exploration of my contemplation of Gnostic ideas, the idea of this demiurge, this being, and correct me if I'm wrong, the demiurge is jealous of the progenitor, and in that jealousy sees this like actual real reality and synthesizes it. That's what we're in, the synthetic version. We're in like the shitty like amusement park version. We're like in a low level Disney. We're the thing trying to be Disney World. It's never going to be Disney World, but it's trying to be the creepy fair or whatever. That's what we're in. Now, but this is something that I was thinking of, and this is something that really gave me the chills. Have you considered, or have the Gnostics written anything about the possibility that we are the demiurge? That the reason we're here is not because we're souls that have been trapped within matter, but that we are the dragon thing, and the only way to protect the rest of whatever the rest of everything is from us is to keep us mesmerized and eternally trapped with our own narcissistic interaction with our own identity.
Oh yeah, I mean, what did the hermetic say? As above, so below. We are what happens in heaven corresponds on earth. And Philip K. Dick was the one who said, "Yeah, you may think of archons, but we are the true archons. We give our consent. We dilute ourselves. We project outward." Some have said the demiurge is simply our human faulty way of seeing God. As soon as we change our attitude on what God is, then we see the real God. But of course, that takes wisdom. So that is definitely possible. I mean, maybe we sent ourselves down to play a role in a video game. You know, our true selves are up there and we've said, okay, you're going to forget. Miguel and Duncan are going to forget who we really are, and they're going to be down as meat sacks in this, you know, this video game talking on a podcast for points. So that's another possibility.
Well, as
I always tell people, yeah, if you these days when people ask me about Gnosticism, I said, think of a simulation theory as Elon Musk and Neil deGrasse Tyson and others have said. Again, nobody in Western history really talked about simulation theory except the Gnostics 2,000 years ago, and probably Plato with his allegory of the cave. And then change that to, and then mix that with cosmic horror, Lovecraft. What does it say? We're not alone in the universe, but what's with us is far more powerful, probably indifferent, or made us and wants to eat us. And if you step too far from the road, if you explore too far, if you ask too many questions, go too high in the sky, these giant supernatural things, these lizard people, these archons, they're just going to eat you, even if they created us and we're already their food. Combine them and you've got a good model for Gnosticism, except Gnosticism is not nihilistic. It's more Christian existentialist. It's almost hopeless, but at the end of the day, we have the power if we wake up.
But this is what I really want to get to, which is that part of it. I mean, this is of all the aspects of Gnosticism that have confused me the most. It's the Gnosis part. This is it enlightenment? Is this is Gnosis equivalent to Eastern ideas of enlightenment?
Well, I mean, there are parallels between Buddhism and Gnosticism. It's pretty apparent. The illusionary world, how the self is almost unknowable, reincarnation, a deep sense of introspection. But Gnosis, to start with, is, as somebody said wisely, it's not the result, it's what brings the result. When Neo takes the red pill, that's it. That's Gnosis. He sees the world as it is, and Morpheus says you're the one, but he still's got to do the work.
Oh,
you still have
fuck.
To do the rituals to bring about your divine spark and reconnect it with the alien god so that in communion you become fully divine. And what's interesting, what's misrepresented about the Gnostics is people say, well, they're just spiritual bypassers. They wanted to do these rituals and fly away to beyond the universe and commune with God and forget it. No, they wanted to be transformed into fully humans to help the world. One scholar called the Gnostics, they were Christian bodhisattvas. To be fully human is to be fully divine, the Gnostics said. And you're not fully human unless you're down here helping others. They believed in healing, good works, trying to wake others up. Like, you know, hey man, can you wake up? Let's do these rituals. So Gnosis is, I'd say, the entire process. But at the end of the day, that feeling of ecstasy, pure joy, that's indescribable. There's no name for that. I mean, salvation, I don't know.
Samadhi. These rituals, I'm not familiar with any Gnostic rituals, or what does this look like? Were they Were they taking some kind of psychedelic? Is it Kaikion and the Eleusian mysteries? Yeah. Is this wrapped up in it?
Yeah, good point. If you look at the rituals, many are very similar to what we know of the mystery religions. That idea of ego death, like the Freemasons where they bury you in a coffin, or as you go down to Hades. I don't know if you've done ayahuasca, but one of the first things about ayahuasca is that every fear, every insecurity you have gets thrown at your face 1,000 times. You want to die. You feel like you are in the pit of a grave. Hmm. And these rituals by the Gnostics were like that. It seems that you're going down to hell. Demons are tearing you apart. And you were able to withstand it. But it's all ego death. It's your ego just being torn apart. When it's completely torn apart, then these rituals, which they probably reenacted, would send you up to heaven and through this star portal. And in the rituals that we know, there was ointments, there was drinks. Some church fathers said when the Gnostic, like this guy Marcus the Magician, he would put like some herbs and it would change and they would drink it and the women would just change. They were stoned. And so then you go through these rituals where you sort of awaken. And in
I'm
these
sorry,
rituals,
what do you mean they would change? Like you mean their
consciousness.
Their
high.
Consciousness or their bodies or like
No, they're conscious. They were okay, an altered state of consciousness. And then you would have these ecstatic flights. And again, when I did ayahuasca, I did leave my body a few times. And but you would be armed with these passwords because to the Gnostics it was like a video game. Every level of heaven or the dimensions, some of them had like 365 dimension, each ruled by an archon. Wow. You had to give this archon a password or a magical word so you could then go and make contact with the supreme mind and come down and be more fulfilled or individuated each time. Now, that's just one ritual, because some Gnostics, as they've proposed, the Gnostics were so, they were such anarchists that they divided into lodges. Some think that the religion started with ancient Egyptian priests who were kind of disillusioned with the Roman Empire, who brought these ancient mysteries to like dissatisfied Jews or pagans, and they started talking and doing these rituals. That's how Gnosticism started, because the ancient Egyptian mysteries do have a lot of Gnostic elements, and of course they added their own ideas. But the important thing, as some scholars have said, and that confuses people, is that first comes the gnosis. It's like, oh my God, I realize there's something wrong with the world. I feel something stirring. But what am I going to do about it? Well, I need to find the rituals or the people that can facilitate this gnosis. Mm. So therefore, you have a varied group or a catalog of rituals. Some Gnostics would do sex magic. Others would do sacramental practices in Rome. Others would do dancing or mystery religions. That's why people have called Gnosticism a parasite religion, because it sort of infiltrates different religions, like the Sufis in Islam or the Christian Gnostics in Rome, because they wanted to absorb the rituals of different cultures and use them and adopt them into their own practices. But they always involved altered states of consciousness, ecstatic feelings, and so forth. So, I mean, the Sufis, the dancing dervishes, that right there is a way you just slam coffee and you dance until you just feel Allah coursing through you. So that's what confuses people, why the Gnostics had such varied rituals. But that's because as they came to different parts of the world, they needed to sort of find what was going on in the culture that they could adopt. Some of the, obviously, the mystery religions, ones that I've told you, are from the early times in Alexandria. There's another one where simply doing contemplation until you have gnosis. You sit there and you just start thinking about the material world. You start analyzing yourself. until you start feeling something stirring in altered states of consciousness. There were some groups of Gnostics that would just sit in a group and tell each other problems. 2,000 years ago, they're doing group therapy. Wow. They're like, my emotions are broken. I need healing. I'm trauma. I mean, Carl Jung did call the Gnostics history's first depth psychologist because, again, they saw our mind as the mind of God, and they would really explore who we were very deeply, and they were into dreams, altered states of consciousness, and just human development.
Do you ever worry that technology, or, you know, the potential of some technological superintelligence is a way for these archons to go from being a kind of, what's it called, an egregore, or sort of invisible thing, to a visible ruling force? Does that ever creep in when you're considering, like, the hockey stick of, you know, that we're looking at, that Ray Kurzweil and the transhumanists talk about? You ever wonder, like, oh shit, the AI is the archon descending or appearing to, like, you know, finish the job, to eliminate the last flickering bit of hope that we'll ever be able to achieve this gnosis that produces the potential for liberation?
Yeah, that's well said, and I would agree. I mean, the archons are depicted as mechanistic, animalistic, soulless. They could easily, they sound almost like AI or some sort of machine. And of course, that's exactly their goal, is the complete snuffing of human awareness. I mean, it even says, I think, in the Gospel of Philip, the mother of all sins is ignorance. To the Gnostics, that was the worst sin, because anybody who's connected with themselves and consciousness will be a good person, because that's really the natural state of a human being. I mean, you know, dogs don't do stupid things to each other. They follow their nature so the pack will survive. Human beings awake are going to be doing good and working together and be full of empathy. That's what Philip K. Dick called the divine spark. Empathy, I mean, that's something that's very rare in the universe. And the archons, their job is to stifle our awareness, make us machine-like, make us asleep so they can keep feeding off of us. And that's always been their goal. And they have different ways, obviously, in their texts. Sometimes they talk about the Garden of Eden as an evil place, because in the Gnostic text, Adam and Eve are trapped there, and Jesus has to turn into the serpent to wake them up. And he's like, look, all these fruits and beautiful things, that's what's keeping you trapped. Wake the fuck up. And we can look right now, our phones and social media and all this bullshit divide and conquer stuff you see on the internet and from politicians. It can be something materialist that makes us fall asleep, but also they use fear. One thing the archons love to do, and very much in the text, is they love to rape. And this is the great analogy. They love to take away our agency. They love to make us fearful, and they love to make sure that we disassociate with our own consciousness and fragment until we have no idea who we are. So yeah, as above, so below, I would say AI, transhumanism is a great reflection of the archons up there. And the Gnostics would be horrified at it.
Well,
they'd be like,
I mean,
fuck this.
But you know what? I feel like with any of the, you know, with transhumanism in particular, I've got many transhumanist friends. I just did the Singularity University podcast. I love Ray Kurzweil. And I think that transhumanism and all of the technological, incoming technological realities do present the possibility of, you know, going even deeper into the never-ending fractalizing quagmire of the material universe, but potentially another avenue for liberation that you can't have, like what you were saying in the beginning. If you're going to have some self-reflective consciousness, and then that's going to create the never-ending iteration that we call reality, then within that you're always going to have the thing and its opposite, the dialectic or whatever. So potentially transhumanism, definitely it could be the thing where death, like, that's what I love about Gnosticism. It flips everything on its head. Christians hearing, like, what are you talking about? Jesus was not the serpent, friend. You know, that that Gnosticism, and I think this is why the early Christians were like, fuck you, Gnostics, right? I read that much of what we know about Gnosticism is from the early Christians bitching about Gnosticism and why it's wrong. But I think Christians might say, look, you're going to get this, you're going to get Christianity, and the first thing that's going to happen is the devil is going to take that pure, beautiful, very clear, to all of it totally makes sense, and warp it and make turn it into something confusing. It's like the most confusing shit already. Then no one needs to do anything to it. But, you know, I love your YouTube channel. And, you know, I've learned a lot from it. But, you know, I would like one thing I love. This is an old one from 2014. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the guest. But, you know, you were talking about the Garden of Eden. And you were talking about the weirdness of that story. And he was saying, look, if you want to, you know, accept the Garden of Eden as it is in the Christian book of Genesis, you got to do some heavy fucking lifting for that shit to work. Because you've got a deceptive God, a plural deceptive God. They're saying we, they've become like us. Who's the we? Who's the us? Who's the thing that came down and were with the daughters of men? What the fuck is any of that shit? And it's in the very first book of the Bible that's in the churches where people are like, this is totally normal. Totally normal. It's totally normal that God would keep us in a garden and lie to us, that the tree would kill us. It didn't kill us. I'm going to side with the Gnostics when they're like, you're supposed to think that's fucked up. You're supposed to hear that story and be like, what's, why would you do that to us? Why would you put the tree there?
As kids, I question it. Didn't you question it? Weren't you like, I know I'm going to get slapped for this, but I'm going to side with Adam and Eve on this one and the snake.
Exactly. I mean, that's the forbidden words. I grew up in Western North Carolina, and I remember in our algebra class, the algebra teacher taking a little break from teaching us math and deciding to like go into how a snake can talk.
and there's nothing in that the snake is Satan. That was added later on. And then the flood story right there. I mean, I was very lucky. My mom was a very progressive Catholic and read Joseph Campbell. So she was like, oh, these are just myths of ancient people. But because I'd be like, you know, God is, he's drowning the sinners, but what about the babies and the kittens? What did they ever do to God? What a monster. It just made no sense.
The unicorns.
He drowned the dinosaurs. He drowned the dinosaurs.
The dinosaurs, unicorns, the Sasquatch. God only knows. I'm sure there's a, God literally only knows. I'm sure there's a plethora of adorable mythological creatures that got drowned because God was mad at a few dumbasses.
Or they got eaten in the ark. Noah got hungry and, you know, ate all the griffins or something.
The fucking gnomes. He found out the gnomes taste like chocolate. You know, started going down there in the middle of the night when he couldn't sleep. Chomped up some gnomes. But, you know, I love this verse. It, you know, Jacob's Ladder, by the way, another glorious Gnostic parable in cinema. If you haven't seen it, y'all, it's amazing. The original, I think they remade it, but the original's incredible. And his, you know, chiropractor is an angel.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, that's it.
That's it. Please, the back adjustment. My first encounter with Meister Eckhart was from his chiropractor in Jacob's Ladder, where he says, the part of the soul that burns in hell is the part that clings to life. Mm. And wrapped up in that to me is the idea that if you want this grand reunion with the original progenitive force, there's a price. And the price is everything.
Everything.
You have to let go
completely.
All of it. Completely. You can't hold on to this world at all.
Amen. And yes, that's what I love the Gnostics, because of they took a really hard stance against evil and suffering, very much like the Buddhists. They said, nope, we're drawing the line. Like you said, there is only one way to become who we really are, and we just gotta let go. That's the only way, as the guy says in the movie, those demons will turn into angels. You gotta let go. And most religions, oh no, materialism's okay. Everything's gonna be fine. Oh, evil is the absence of good, and we're gonna be saved. The Gnostics, and to an extent the Buddhists, were like, no, we're punk rockers. We're going to spiritual war, and we are not compromising one inch with you, with the world, with everything. We're getting the fuck out of here.
What does it look like? I mean, what to you, what does that look like from in the times that we're in now? What does that level of letting go look like?
Well, I don't think it has to look like anything. I mean, yes, if you look historically, the Gnostics were part of the community. They were going to the universities. They were learned men and women. They're far more accepting of women. But again, it's your attitude. It's who you are. It's nothing. It's almost like it's nothing you're going to do. And it's your ideas that are going to make you dangerous. I mean, you look, for example, the Cathars, the famous medieval heretics that Dan Brown made famous and have been part of lore in Europe, they were very Gnostic. And they would go around in southern France talking about, they switched the Demiurge to Satan, but they'd said, no, this world is ruled by Satan. You got to give up your material possessions when you're ready. That's all they always said. If you want to be part of the inner circle, when you're ready, you join us. But they would go preaching this existential, crazy, edgelord kind of shit. And they were beloved by the people in southern France. The Catholics loved them. They were protected by the Knights Templar and everything. So my point is sometimes it's not so much what you're doing as how your ideas are affecting people and are affecting others, because the Cathars became an existential threat to the church, just like the Gnostics, and they had to bring down the weight of the church and of political power in Europe to take them down. I mean, the Inquisition started with the Cathars and then moved on to women and Jews and, you know, other people. So it's your ideas that are going to change the world, because if you have the mind of God, Duncan, then you are endless imagination, you are bottomless innovation, you are just exploring, you are an artist creating just new reality and greater realities. That's how you change things. You make the universe a more beautiful place, a different place, but that's going to piss off the Archons. And as soon as you have those ideas, they're going to come after you hard.
To me, when I'm thinking of this, it feels like there's a weird pathway here to, for lack of a better word, transcendence. This kind of like just waking up, like waking from completely waking from the material universe and being home. Like, you know, the wonderful thing that happens when you have the shitty dream where you're like being mauled by a bear and then you remember, oh, I'm having a dream. And then you're like, oh, I'm just being mauled by a bear. It's a dream. And then you wake up and you forget about it. It's just done. It isn't to me, and I think the spiritual bypass critique maybe is related to the sense that there is this possibility of not, you know, they say in the world but not of the world. Right, but it feels like in Gnosticism there's this idea of like actually you can actually not be in the world.
You can go and gain this power from the God, this remembrance of who you used to are. But your job is still in the world. Again, I call them Christian bodhisattvas. It's almost like either we all get out or none of us get out. You're here in the wheel. And it even talks, there's a book called The Secret Book of John. And Jesus says, no, if you start waking up, look for somebody who's more advanced than you in lifetimes and hang on to his robe or have him teach you how to wake up further. So they did. The Gnostics did have sort of this Christian idea where you really had to help people, whether it's helping the poor in the material world or helping others try to wake up. There was never that idea of spiritual bypass. If anything, you look at the early Christian church, the desert fathers and the monks in the Byzantine Empire, they're the ones that would go into caves or on top of trees or monasteries and starve themselves, and we must be holy and piety. The Gnostics were the ones like, no, we need to be out with the people and see and, you know, connect with them at their level and create myth and stories that they'll understand and try to help them wake up.
Whoa! That's so intense. So what you're saying, it makes me think, oh, yeah, they didn't go anywhere. They're here just as much as they ever were. But the way that we know them is through all the art that gives that fluttering feeling in your chest where you're like, wait, no, that's more than just a movie. I'm sorry. It might be cheesy. And honestly, I'm so sick of people saying it's like the fucking Matrix. Honestly, it's like so annoying when someone's like, no, it's like the goddamn Matrix. That's why it's a great fucking movie. It's so annoying.
It's the most powerful modern myth we have today. You got to know, it used to be like the Wizard of Oz. Every analogy when we were young was the Wizard, even though the Wizard of Oz is Gnostic. People relate to the Matrix because as a myth, I think we all know it's kind of true. What does Morpheus say? You know there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is. It's like a splinter in your mind driving you crazy. It's the most popular myth today because all of us subconsciously know it's true. You know that song Leonard Cohen, Everybody Knows?
Yeah.
He was influenced by Kabbalah. So we all know unconsciously that the game is rigged, the dice was loaded from the start, and we are trapped. And I think as humans beings, we're never going to be satisfied where we are. Maybe that's, we are aliens because we're always looking for something else.
So it's like, this something else, it's not just a you know, phantasmal aspiration. It's a legitimate, like, homesickness, but the kind of homesickness you get when you have amnesia, I guess. It's like,
bingo.
I don't even know what I'm fucking homesick for, but I miss it so much. Well, so
yeah, there's a saying by this Egyptian writer called Nagui Mafos. And it says, home is not where you are born. Home is where all your attempts to escape cease. And as humans, we're always trying to escape something. Some of us are misguided and we escape through material things, TV, sex. Others are still feel that our home is just somewhere else. And we're always trying to escape. I don't think we humans belong, but we can be good caretakers of the cosmos, even if we're trapped.
Whoa, that's so beautiful. It's like, so the invitation is not to escape. The invitation is to be here and find out a way to articulate this truth so that it inspires other people.
Exactly.
Wow.
Well, I couldn't have said it better. Yeah, even Joseph Campbell used to say, and he's obviously going with Hinduism and Advaita Vedanta, but he used to say, yes, the universe is a whore. Anybody who says that it isn't is completely delusional. What did somebody say? The first sound of the universe wasn't om, it was munch. I mean, who the hell created a universe where everything has to eat something to survive? That's demented. It's demented. A universe of viruses and death and Taylor Swift. I mean, it's just demented. And Joseph Campbell, you say that, yeah, the universe is a whore, but you got to be okay with it. In fact, you got to embrace it. You got to say, this is bad. I accept it. In fact, I love it. And let's work together to make it better.
That's that. If yes, I think that prescription ruins the entire game. If the game is one of fractalization or division or infinite, constant, schizoid, never-ending shattering, then that's the only way that would stop it is you just, it's, God, what is it that, my meditation teacher, I'm sorry, David, if you are listening to this, because I'm going to totally ruin what you misquote. I think you're misquote, probably,
and then it's going to get on social media and they'll get misquoted more.
It's from a Buddhist scripture. It's the idea that, oh God, I forget I even mentioned David Nichter. It's the idea that everything is already broken. It's broken beyond repair. Mm-hmm. It broke a long time ago. And so, like, going around and, like, doing this, you know, the sad thing where something that someone loves shatters on the ground and they're like, oh my God, get the pieces and the glue and we'll get it back to where it was. Yeah. And but it keeps breaking and breaking and it's broken. Hey, just enjoy how beautiful the little bits of glass look when they're shining in the light. And that's the best you can do. And it's maybe in there, the frenzied, never-ending attempt to shift the damn thing around so it makes sense ceases, and then some peace comes, right? Is that the idea?
I think so, yeah. I love it. Yeah, just accept everything's broken. I think the Gnostics, people ask when the end of the world is. The Gnostics said, no, the end of the world already happened. Once God fragmented and became crazy, that was Armageddon, and we're sort of floating in the flotsam and jetsam of this, and we've got to swim back to the beginning. Even Philip K. Dick used to say how Simon Magus and Paul and Buddha, they were actually traveling backwards in time instead with us humans because they wanted to get to the beginning. One thing that the Gnostics were obsessed with, what's why they were called depth psychologists, is they always wanted to go back to the Garden of Eden, to history, to their own past. Because I know we live in a time that says, oh, live in the present, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, all of us, each one of us has an amazing amount of trauma. Even if you don't have trauma, we've got ancestral trauma. We've got our country's trauma. We've got the gods' trauma. So they thought they wanted to go back to find out what had happened and understand it and in a strange way rectify it, even if it was just sort of a fiction or, you know, trying to write about, was it? I mean, what is the story Pinocchio says? If you want to find the end, go back to the beginning and pretend. That's in Pinocchio. And in the Gospel of Thomas, the apostles ask him, well, how do we know how the end is? And Jesus says, the end? If you want to know the end, go to the beginning and you will rule over all. So the Gnostics, again, they were like history's first depth psychologists. And again, that's why I liked them, because I got tired of these religions saying, live in the present. How come I've got all this trauma as a kid? You know what I mean? I've got all this shadow and versions and dreams and unconscious behavior. I'm like, I keep getting in the same fight with my wife and it reminds me of my dad. So I don't want to live in the present anymore. I want to find out how I got so fucked up.
Wait a minute. I thought I was the only one who got in the same fight with his wife that reminded him of his dad.
It's like we're programmed. Yeah, no, all of us.
Holy shit. That's crazy. You too. Yeah, I know. Like a... Well, it's, you know, isn't it, the way it's been described to me is it's more along the lines of like, yeah, the present with all your apps running, which that's your trauma, that's your story, that's the whole, all of it, the which is a very real thing. Yes, that, fuck that present. I don't want to be in that neurotic, never-ending vortex of self-criticism and meeting my own narcissism, meeting self-criticism, you know, this infinite, horrible.
We are the demiurge.
Yes, yeah, but that's the story. But underneath that story is the thing where I've had it happen a few times where you wake up after you've been in the horrible fight with your wife, after you've been in some awful thing has happened the night before, and it's like your system, before it boots up, what happened the night before, you're laying in bed and you're like, ah, what a beautiful day. And you know what I mean? And then you remember, oh, fuck, I got a DUI. My car got impounded. Oh, my God, I said that to whoever? You know, but before that, it is, I think that's what they mean when they say the present moment is that eternal, fundamentally good reality that is uncorruptible. You can't, what are you going to do? Like the way Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche puts it is, you know, look at color. Just look at color. Color's perfect. What are you going to do? I mean, like, who's going to, you know, maybe color relatively, you can have some problems. Certain colors, like, don't look great together. But, like, you know what I mean? If you just see a shade of green, you would be out of your mind if you're like, look at that malfunctioning fucking color there. You know, that's the story. Maybe that's the demiurge. It's just a bullshit story.
Yeah, saying yes to the moment, as they say. Yeah, or what we call it, what we say in AA, acceptance is the solution to all my problems. But I agree 100%, but I also agree with Carl Jung and marketing and Edward Bernays and all that, that what we are, Duncan or Miguel, is a small fraction what we think we are, and the rest is this giant iceberg of shadow material, trauma, complexes, and, you know, the powers that be know this, from Edward Bernays to Steve Jobs. I'm in marketing, and we all know you don't market to somebody's consciousness, you market to their unconscious, because that's who's making the decisions in life. When we go shopping, as science has said, we have already made a decision 5 seconds before our conscious mind has made the decision. They've tracked it, the part of our brain. So what we are is ultimately a construct. And if this construct wants to enjoy the present, fine. But I believe I want to understand the entirety of who Miguel is, this vast ocean of unconscious, just as I want to explore the mind of the true God. And I think that's what my goal is. And that's why I respect Gnosticism, because I'm not going to accept that this little fragment, this thing, this iceberg over the water is all Miguel will ever be. And same with Duncan. Duncan is just this divinity, and there's so much going on. Yeah, when you and your wife are fighting, or my wife are fighting, I think there's about 40 people fighting at the same time. There's my wife when she was 10. There's me when I was 15. There's me who got hit by my drunken alcoholic dad. There's me who got rejected at prom. There's my wife and her, you know, there's a lot going on. We are legion, as I
was about to say it. We are legion.
We are legion.
Somebody throw me into some fucking pigs. Please send me over the cliff. I'm ready. I
think that's what
pigs.
Jesus means. I think he's doing therapy.
We are legion, a swarm. Oh, Miguel, thank you so much for this. What a joy to get to ask you all. You've cleared up so much, created a lot more confusion in a really beautiful way for me. I'm just so, we're lucky that we have you. Can you tell people where they can find you?
Sure, sure. And yeah, I'd be glad to come on again and talk about different aspects of Gnosis. We've only tip of the iceberg. The Legion is still hasn't been covered.
Even close. But you know, God, what a great tip. I mean, yes. And I will, anytime you have the time, I would love to have you back on.
Awesome. Yeah. For my website is surprising nobody, thegodabovegod.com, because it has to be Gnostic. And there you'll find information on my podcast, Aeon Byte, my books, my articles, social media, movies that I've made, short movies, anything you want. If you want to contact me with some questions, please do so. But everything you need, and a ton of articles on Gnosticism, introductory too, go to thegodabovegod.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Miguel. It's been a real pleasure.
I had a blast. Thank you.
That was Miguel Connor, everybody. All the links you need to find Miguel will be at DuncanTrussell.com, or you can just go to his website, GodAboveGod.com. A tremendous thank you to our wonderful sponsors, Squarespace and Shudder, and a big thank you to you for subscribing to the DTFH. I love you so much. I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna. Stay out of the Matrix.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.